Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Born to Talk radio show. And my guest is actually a returning guest. I'm so happy to have him here. He is Gary L. Polk, Sr. He's a Black businessman, president and CEO of the Polk Institute and Foundation. He is so much. He is also a business consultant. He's a university professor, and he's an author. And as you will hear, Gary is passionate about entrepreneurs and why they succeed, or perhaps why they fail. Welcome back to the show, Gary.
Marcia, thank you for having me back.
It's a pleasure. And for those people that might have missed that show, because, God, that was several years ago, why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, briefly, I'm an L.A. product. My family origin is from Texas, but I've been here all my life. Personally, I have three adult kids. I have five grandkids. I have two dogs and one wife.
well, I love it. You just have the one wife.
Yeah.
Multiples of everything else.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I love historical fiction. I'm a big reader. 35 years ago, a friend of mine, a female friend, and I started a co-ed book club, and we're still going strong.
Oh, nice.
I'm an L.A. sports fan, and I like to travel to Maui. My wife was born in Maui.
Oh, nice. Well, that's mm-hmm. a pretty nice place to visit.
So, very nice.
Very nice. So we're going to talk about what it is you do, my friend, and you are also a proponent of social entrepreneurship and launched the Polk Institute and the Polk Institute Foundation. And I will make sure that people see your website because it is fabulous. And that was launched on January the 15th of 2021 with the first cohort starting in February. And, you know, Gary, I think that what's important to me when I have people on my show that know precisely what it is they do because they're very familiar with the terminology, there may be others maybe listening going, I wonder what a cohort is. So for those who may not know, would you please tell people what is the definition of a cohort?
You know, that is a good question because it is a little bit odd. But basically, a cohort is a group of people who may take a training or educational class together. And the trainers or teachers actually rotate. So the group of people, let's say you and I are in a cohort class and there's 20 of us. Uh-huh. We might take a series of 10 courses together. We start together. We end together. But during that time, we may see 10 different instructors. And that's literally what a cohort is. It's really common in education and in training programs. And again, the real key is that the group starts together and usually ends together. You may have a little people fall in and out, but basically the group stays together the entire time. So that's pretty cool. Normally in a college setting, you have students taking different classes with different professors, and they don't stay together. They may hit one class or two. But the cohort mentality, that group stays together. That's really the key to it.
I see. You know, I mentioned that you are a university professor. Are you currently teaching, sir?
Yes, I teach at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills in Carson, California. And I've been there since 2003. So I'm in my 23rd year teaching there. But I actually started teaching at Cal State Northridge in 1991. And before that, I'd never dreamed of teaching. But within 3 years of teaching, the funny story was that in 3 years, they had this program that I was a part of. And they ran out of money. And I said, well, that's okay. I'm doing it part-time, and I'll do it for free.
Wow.
And they said, you will? Don't tell the union. We'll let you teach for free. I wanted to keep my teaching continuity going. So I did that. And that semester, I worked just as hard as if I was being paid. And that's when I realized that teaching maybe was my passion. Fast forward another 5 years, around 98 or so, I decided I'd quit corporate America. I would teach full time at the college level and coach high school girls basketball. I was getting ready to become a district manager at Farmers and take over 27 offices in the LA County area. But my oldest was 15, my middle was 13, and my daughter was 10. And I've been working 70, 80 hours a week at a very key time to my kids. And I wanted to be there for them and with them. And it left a lot of money on the table, but it was the best decision I ever made.
I love that. You know, Gary, I forgot you coached basketball. Wow, we'll have to talk about that a little later. So I know that the focus of our podcast today is to really talk about how you have affected so many people. And I thought we could start by asking this question of you. Why was the Polk Institute and the foundation created?
That's a great question. And I've been asked that many times, but we all can remember March 2020 when COVID hit and things really changed. I was at the university. We had just started a new semester. We got an email from our president saying something has happened. Things are going to change. Be ready for change. 2 days later, classes were suspended for 2 weeks. At first, they were going to do it only for 1 week, and they found out many professors were not ready to teach online or in a modular system, and they introduced us something called Zoom, where now we're going to use Zoom technology, and instead of being in class, we would have virtual classes. So it took about 2 weeks, and that became an interesting time because I was doing some consulting with the SBA, and we had clients coming in person one-on-one. So all of a sudden with Zoom technology, we had one-on-one consulting. We were teaching classes in a group session using Zoom, and there was a lot of negativity and uncertainty around COVID-19. So in September 2020, I decided I'm going to start my own nonprofit, and we're going to provide entrepreneur education. We're going to target underrepresented Black and brown, and we were going to offer this for free using Zoom technology, because now we had an ability to teach a group and have one-on-one coaching. So COVID, during this dark time, we wanted to be a positive light in this negative period. And that was really the nucleus or the emphasis behind starting the Polk Institute. And actually, Marcia, Polk Institute Foundation is one of the same. We call it the Polk Institute kind of like PI, a little play on the verb there, PI. But then it's the Polk Institute Foundation, which is a nonprofit, but it's just one entity.
I see. Thank you for explaining that, because I was a little bit confused about that. So the Polk Institute Foundation is your .org. That is your, yes. I see.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because I want our listeners to, you know, first of all, that is the PolkInstitute.org is your website.
And right.
It's a wonderful, wonderful website, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you.
There are so many things there that are so interesting from maybe people. I mean, I'm thinking there's lots of people that might want to partake in this, either as being somebody that's learning something, or maybe that's somebody that wants to be a mentor. But we'll be talking about that as we move through our conversation together.
Okay.
So let's talk about the mission of the foundation and the training and the students and how they apply. That's a long question, and I'm really interested in hearing your response to that.
Okay, so our mission is to serve social entrepreneurs to help make the world a better place. And we coined that in 2020, and here we are in 26, and it still makes me feel good when I say that. Our vision is to serve 1,000 social entrepreneurs by the year 2032. Wow. So we have a very aspirational vision of what we want to try to do. What we really do is we provide training and technical expertise in the entrepreneur space. We focus on startups. We focus on early stage businesses. We don't call them students. We're not an education organization per se. So we call them clients.
Oh,
and what we do is we provide training and technical expertise. We decided not to go the education route and go through the accreditation that could take 5 or 6 years. As a training organization, you don't have to go through that type of rigorous, and they can be very rigorous going through accreditation. Being in academics, I know. So we bring in clients. We bring in what we call our incubator group, which is startup, usually pre-revenue. And one thing we wanted to do that was very important, student debt back in when I did my research in 2020 was $1.6 trillion. Wow. And the article that I read from U.S. News and World Report talked about the average college student had a $33,000 student debt. If you went to a private or an Ivy, it was over $100,000. So then in the same article, it talked about 15 universities in the U.S. that are tuition free. And I said, wow, that's interesting. I've been teaching almost 20 some years here. Never heard of that. So when I dug a little deeper, it turns out that our five military academies are all tuition free. So West Point, the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy, et cetera. And they're paid for by what? Our tax dollars. But it's tuition free. So we decided we would do the Polk Institute Foundation. We provide tuition free training and technical expertise in the area of entrepreneurship, because I am definitely a capitalist and I believe it's more about working for profit and working for yourself as opposed to working for big organizations. And COVID really made that a big point, because they had, the Great American Walkaway, or they had some day where people were just leaving their jobs because they found out they were tired of their boss, they were tired of their company, they want to have their own financial freedom. And during COVID, entrepreneurship just exploded. And we started off targeting Black and brown, but lo and behold, women became, in 2 years, 81% of our clients were women.
Wow.
So we said we may as well start targeting women and veterans as well. So people say, well, are you exclusive? And the answer is no. If you know marketing, you want to have a target market. That doesn't mean you're excluding anyone. It just means that when you're doing your targeting and your marketing dollars, you have to figure out where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. But we are inclusive and we accept all types. So we have Asian, we have white, we have other races, Middle East, but we do target Black and brown, and now we also target women and veterans. We want to help those who don't always have the opportunity and resources to start a business. And that's really what's behind us. So every year we have an application process where you apply online, you submit an application and a video, and then we have a selection panel. Three or four people come in, and they interview for about 45 minutes. We want to find out a little bit about the person firsthand. One of the main things we're trying to figure out, are you coachable? Because I was a coach, I know the difference between those who are coachable and those who are not. Those who are not coachable are not really fun to work with. We decided we want to only work with people that are coachable, because in two other incubators that I started or involved with before the Polk Institute, we use that as one of our criteria. If you're coachable, we'd love to work with you. If you're not coachable, goodbye, because you're no fun.
You
know it all, so you don't need us.
It's interesting. I'm going to ask for another definition here. You know, when I hear the word incubator, I think of a baby. So what do you mean when you say an incubator group? What's that definition?
You know, that is a great question, because when you incubate something, it's like when I think of it, I think of about a chicken ready to hatch.
Oh, that's
And the
funny.
Idea then is the business is ready to hatch, but it's not quite ready. So you want to give it some comfort. You want to give them some warmth, and you want to teach what they don't know. Because what we really understand, business owners in the startup world, they don't know what they don't know.
Yes.
So they need help. But they need help from mentors who've been there, done that, willing to volunteer their time and offer this help. So we use mentors. I didn't tell you this, but in 2014, I took over the South Bay Entrepreneurial Center, a city-based incubator located down in Torrance. In 2011, the city of Torrance gave them $100,000 to start this city-based incubator. by 2014, when I got there, they ran through all their money. And I thought it was odd that a business incubator own business model didn't work. So I looked at what they had there. I did a SWOT analysis and I did some more research. And one of the amazing things that this incubator had, they had like 30 people volunteer to be mentors. And I met with the mentors, and it was interesting because some mentors were overly used and some mentors were never used. And I thought that didn't make sense.
Well, because,
well, and that's a good question. Why was that? And when I started digging deeper, when they would bring in a new client, they'd say, here's our mentor pool. Talk to anybody you want to, and they can help you. Well, it became almost a popularity contest. So I said, that's not a good use of resources. Let's ask our clients, what help do you need? What is your area of expertise that you need help in? And let us find someone with that background. So we came up with a strategy that we would find a primary mentor that would act like a PPO primary physician. They would work with them every day. But then if they needed a specialty, we had a second class called a specialty mentor that could come in like an oncologist, a podiatrist with that specialty need. So now we gave them a primary mentor to work with on a regular basis and a specialty mentor bring in when needed. And that worked. Now all the mentors were used and all of a sudden these resources were allocated in a much better way. And that's really what turned us around. But then we realized that not only startups, but existing businesses may need our help too. Well, our original plan, we charged $300 for a startup. It didn't work because out of 10 that they were relying on, only two could pay that regularly. Because when you're startup mode, you don't have money. So instead of subsidizing maybe for 10, for two, the organization had to subsidize for 10. I said, well, let's charge existing businesses $500 or $600. And next thing you know, we had a lot of people knocking on our doors asking for mentor help and was willing to pay $500, $600. And all of a sudden, we went from red ink to black ink.
How exciting that must have been. You're talking about a lot of things that personally I'm not familiar with, so I'm interested in what you're saying.
Sure.
So here's another sort of definition kind of question I'd like to ask you, and that is, you've mentioned social entrepreneurship a few times, but I don't know what that is. What is social entrepreneurship?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I didn't know what that was either until 2018. I was now with the... I founded the Innovation Incubator at my university, Cal State Dominguez Hills. And in 1 week, I went to 3 social entrepreneur-related events.
Okay.
And we started out my incubator at the university, and our slogan was, we empower entrepreneurs. I went back to my executive committee and said, we're going to do a pivot. We're going to change directions. We now empower social entrepreneurs. And one of our VPs, she said, well, Gary, everybody can't be a nonprofit. I said, oh, slow down. Social entrepreneurship is about the triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit. And the three can coexist. It's not zero sum. People matter, employees and customers. The planet matters. We only have one. And it's still about profit. And that is the basis of what social entrepreneurship is. If we want to sum it up, we talk about doing good while doing well. So we want to make a profit, but we want to do it the right way. I'm a baby boomer. I was taught the business of business is profit. Forget the planet, forget people, just make a profit. As an educator at the university level, I can tell you firsthand, we've been teaching MBAs profit maximization. Both of those models, in my opinion, are wrong because we can cross that line of ethics and doing the right thing for the sake of profit. And some people have become that greedy person, just profit motivated. There are people that will pollute the ocean, will harm our atmosphere because they want to make a profit, and it's okay. The ocean is vast. Well, yes, it is, but we can one day have more plastic bottles in the ocean than fish if we just constantly throw plastic water bottles into the ocean. That's just one example. So when I found out about we have a new business model, people, planet, profit, the three P's or the triple bottom line, I was all into that. And it's interesting, the triple bottom line was first coined in 1994.
By who?
The guy name was Daniel Elkington.
Okay.
And if you look him up, you'll find he came up with that. So this notion has been around a while. In 2006 in New York, a corporation called the B Corp was formed. And their whole mission is to certify for-profit businesses as social entrepreneurs. And they have this assessment. It's big in the East Coast. It's bigger in Europe and South America than it is in the United States. And it's bigger in Portland and in Seattle than it is in L.A. on the West Coast. I said, well, wait a minute. We're bigger than both of those cities. We are behind the pace. The Polk Institute, we want to start carrying that banner and foster social entrepreneurship. So I talk about that all the time now. And again, we say that social entrepreneurship is in our DNA because it's part of our mission and our vision.
Do your students, I'm using the word student, is that maybe the wrong word?
Clients,
I'm sorry, that's the word, client. Do your clients ever end up becoming mentors themselves?
We've had that happen, absolutely. Sometimes they get involved, they like what we're doing so much. And maybe they're good at sales and marketing, and maybe we need a person to come in sales and marketing. So, yes, I could say we've had over 5 or 6 years, we may have had a half a dozen come back and serve as mentors. We've had some come back and serve as facilitators and actually teach a couple of our workshops. We don't call them classes. Again, we try to stay in that training world instead of that education world.
Right. It is a vocabulary, isn't it?
It really is, yes.
Right.
But our mentors are great people because we don't want our mentors to be paid. We want them to volunteer because we don't want them to have some hidden agenda where if you do this, I can write you a business plan. If you pay me that and this. We want the mentors to be in a position where they are successful already and now they want to give back. And believe it or not, there are a lot of people are in that world that want to give back because someone helped them along the way. And I don't know if you've ever heard the notion of pay it forward.
Yes.
A lot of our mentors talk about this is their chance to pay it forward in a business context.
Wow, that's really interesting. And you've been doing this a while. This is not new to you.
No.
And like I said, you have a fabulous website for people to visit that want to.
Thank you so much.
It really is great. So you've launched something called the Silver Tsunami, and I don't know if you, but I know you can. So why don't you tell our audience what that is all about?
I'm a reader. I do a lot of reading, and I read an article about the Silver Tsunami, and literally the Silver Tsunami is not my phrase. It is out there, and it's really baby boomers. And the Silver Tsunami, what I was reading, was how baby boomers are now ready to retire.
Oh.
And SME, small, medium-sized enterprise, is what the SBA defines as a small business. 40 to 45% of SME-level small businesses are ran by baby boomers. And these baby boomers are now silver and ready to retire. So they call it the Silver Tsunami as it's a big wave. The baby boomers were called boomers because we're the biggest generation. Well, now that generation, that big wave of people are ready to retire. So we decided that we would work on the other end, not just the startup end, but that retirement, that business sell in. And so we came up with the Silver Tsunami Accelerator. We want to help them accelerate or speed up their retirement opportunity. But then as we did more research, because we're just in a pilot phase, we haven't rolled it out officially yet.
Okay.
We realized that maybe a company wants to grow and use merger and acquisition as a strategy to buy an existing business. So now the Silver Tsunami Accelerator is going to be primarily sellers, but also we're going to help buyers and create a marketplace. And what we'd like to do is put this marketplace out there and become a matchmaker. Oh, you want to buy a business? Oh, you want to sell a business? Let us help you. What we found out in our research, if the baby boomer or the Silver Tsunami person spent all their time building a business, most of the time they never got into management succession or start working about, well, what's the next step? And so we feel that, like, you don't know what you don't know when you start a business, you may not know what you don't know about selling a business. So that same principle we're now applying to people who want to retire. So merger and acquisition is a strategy, and you can go to a bank and say, I want to buy an existing business. And the bank will lend you money to buy an existing business, where they'll never lend you money to buy a, to do a startup, because the mortality rate is so high.
Wow.
And so they don't know that there's money. The SBA has a program that lends money to buying a business. Why does everyone have to start from ground zero from scratch to get into a business? Maybe they have this idea, but maybe they could buy an existing business. So this, if you read some like Time Magazine and some of the other business magazines, you're going to find that the Silver Tsunami is a huge, huge opportunity. And if we do it right, it can be very successful for the sellers and the buyers.
Hmm. A win-win, right?
A win-win. And the other thing that should be known is that while I was a banker, I was a commercial lender. And it's very common for second generations not to want the business that dad or uncle or granddad created, or run the business into the ground. And that becomes a tragedy. Mm. So there's three exit options. And one is give it to your family. Two is give it to your employees. Or three is find an investor. And so you don't know what you don't know, so we try to explain how all three could work. We don't tell people what to do. We're advisors. So we want to know what their goals are. Then we try to help them with those goals and that goal attainment. And we provide mentors again in the Silver Tsunami Accelerator to help them with either the acquisition or the sale of the business. But I could tell you that we figured 70% are going to be sellers and 30% are going to be buyers that make up the Silver Tsunami Accelerator.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm just wondering if sometimes these folks come not really knowing what they want.
That is true. That is true. So what we've come up with a program. I'll just give you the kind of top level outline. The first phase is, you want to sell your business? Well, let's talk about your estate. Do you have a living trust? What have you done? What would you like to see done if you don't? Who would get what? What legacy do you want to have? So that takes you on a personal level. And then we say, okay, let's do a business valuation. What do you think your business is worth? Let's take a look at under the hood and kick the tires, as they say. What's your financial? Are your financial books in order? Is your business ready to sell? And Marcia, I think a good analogy would be in real estate, you could have a home that a person have kept in pristine condition. Anything breaks, they fix it immediately. And if it went on the market to sell, it could sell like that because it was ready to go. Mm-hmm. And some people, they don't keep up their home. Things need to be repaired. It may take a year to get it ready for sale to get the top price. And businesses like that too. some are easy to sell and some are going to be more hard to sell because they haven't done things right. But we got to go through the business valuation process. And then the third stage is the strategy. Okay, now we know what you want. Now we have an idea what the business is worth. Now let's see what the market is like and what strategy can we do and use to find sellers for you, I mean, buyers for your business or sellers. And that's really how we work. So we have these three phases. The fourth phase is the deal phase. And that's kind of the X factor because we don't know how long does it take. It could take 30 days to sell a house. It could take 30 days to sell a business. It could take a year to sell a house. It could take a couple years to sell a business, just depending on what those variables are.
Give me an example of the type of business you're talking about. Somebody holds a dry cleaners? I mean, what kind of personal businesses do people have?
Well, you know, that's a good question, too. I got to go back to when I ran the incubators, I was always agnostic. I never wanted to focus on the industry. I wanted to focus on the type of people I worked with, again, being coachable. Same holds true here. So in our pilot, we're working with a tech company. We're working with a restaurant. We're working with a service business because they're different kinds of businesses. And so really it's interesting to have some, let's say, traction experience working with different kinds of businesses. Some businesses are highly in demand. Some are not. Some
you could. Can you give me an example of something that would be highly in demand? I'm just curious.
Well, you could have a restaurant that's been out there with a nice reputation that has a good customer base, and the owner is just ready to sell. And another owner could see that and say, wow, I could make this change and that change, and I could take this, or I could maybe add two or three more. And so where that one restaurant owner only had one unit and got it so far, another with more money, maybe another vision, could say, you know what? I could multiply this. I could see this being more than just a one-unit place. I could have 10 units. I could have 15 units. So that's the idea of, is your business ready to sell and what the books are like? So you could have a computer company. We have a company that they're into computers. And guess what's hot out there today? Cybersecurity.
Oh, boy.
Cybersecurity, if you're doing cybersecurity, you're probably in demand much more than you were 10 years ago. There's something else. Those two letters called AI.
Yeah.
If you're in that AI world. Now, the AI world, you're not going to have baby boomers in that world because it's brand new. But you might have companies that have similar type businesses that could say, you know what? We could add AI to our product line. So again, what we try to do is understand the business itself. We don't have to be an expert in every industry, but if you want to buy into an industry, it would seem that you would have some industry knowledge. And if you don't, that might be a mistake. Right. So there has to be some synergy going on here. And at this point, I could just tell you that one person could see opportunity where another person could see a failure. Sometimes there are people just at the end of the road and they're tired and they want to do something else for their life. And maybe the business is in good shape, but they just want to walk away. So you have a lot of different reasons why people are doing walking away. But we do know the baby boomers, primarily the silver tsunami focus, is the people who are ready to retire and have that time maybe that they didn't spend with their spouse or their kids or their grandkids and want to enjoy their final years.
I'm looking at your website while we're speaking, and I can see where you're talking about the levels, your incubator, your accelerator, your legacy. It's pretty impressive what you're doing here. You've been doing this for quite some time, haven't you, Gary?
Yeah, we started our legacy in 2023 after a few years of starting again, with the idea that we wanted to work with existing businesses. And with the legacy, what we were doing then, we was working on companies that needed management succession plans that weren't really ready to sell. So the legacy was almost our incubator version of the Silver Tsunami, where they're actually ready to sell. So some of the companies that were in our legacy program are moving over to our Silver Tsunami because, yeah, we think we want to sell. But, you know, when you think about it, sometimes the economy will dictate the best time to sell. So, for example, 08, we were in a down economy. You don't want to sell in a down economy because you could lose a lot of money. Ride that economy out, and when things get better, then is the best time to sell. So business have a lot of other things that you're going to have to deal with when it comes to selling a business. Again, it could be a 30-day process. It could be a 2-year process. But a lot of it has to do with planning and getting the right help. And that's one of the things that we want to try to do. We want to try to be the answer to the incubator and the accelerator in those early stages. Now we want to try to become the right help to that final stage of that selling. And that's why we're excited. I'm an educator at heart. I love to teach. And what's really fun is when you're teaching someone and you see that they get it, or they say, wow, thank you. I didn't know that. I was never exposed to that, but now I understand that. And that to me is gratifying.
I bet it is. It's a lot. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not a business owner. I don't make money being a podcaster, which is all right with me. I had no intention of making money doing this. Mm-hmm. So this is a bit over my head, I must admit. But what I can hear in your voice is your passion. Mm. I can hear how much you love what you do. That's very clear to me. And help me understand this, because I don't know if you already told me this, and I don't want to have you repeat yourself, because I'm trying to take this all in by myself here. Did you tell us about who your clients actually are?
Well, I touched on a little bit. I can just tell you that at least 70% of our clients are women. Again, during during the COVID-19, women came out. And again, we're going to help women and men. It doesn't really matter of gender or lifestyle. It's really, are you coachable and do you want help? And you realize that you need help. So that's really the bulk of our clients. We are interested in low to moderate income. We are interested in helping underrepresented. But I wrote 3 books, and we didn't get a chance to talk about that.
We will. I'm going to get to that, okay? We've got a lot of time left on this podcast.
Okay, all right. So just to stay with who we're working with then, again, it's primarily women and veterans at this time, but we also are working with Black and Brown and Asian. Again, we're really inclusive. And what we do for them, we provide mentorship primarily. The mentorship is where it's a one-on-one relationship a lot of times. And we take the Socratic approach by asking questions.
Okay.
Consultants tell you what to do. Advisors say, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do it? And now let's talk about how we can get that done. So I tell all my clients, we tell our clients, you get 2 votes. We get 1. That means you win every argument. You make every decision. Because at the end of the day, you must make that decision. And if you make the right decision, you can look in the mirror and say, I did it right. If you make the wrong decision, you look in the mirror and say, I messed up. I made a mistake. Uh-huh. But one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that when you run a business, you make a lot of decisions. And one of the things that we try to teach is that we already know that if you make decisions with your heart in a business environment, you're probably going to make a mistake. Well, if you use the left brain and become analytical, you can overanalyze the decision and run into what's called analysis paralysis, uh-huh. where you just beat it to death and you can still make a bad decision. So what we foster, go with your gut. Mm-hmm. Let your gut be your guide to that tough decision. Because your gut, it's going to encompass your education, your experience, and just your feel from inside. And if you go with your gut, you rarely hear people say, I went with my gut and made a mistake. You hear a lot of the other kind of mistakes. I went with my heart. I overthought it. But even if you do make a mistake by going with your gut, that's when you got to give yourself some grace, because after all, we're human and we are going to make mistakes. But I submit that if you go with your gut, you're probably going to make better decisions in the long run. But the other thing I want to add to that is that we teach ethical leadership. When I went into banking, I knew nothing about business. They taught me the 5 C's of credit. Number one C was character. Capacity is the ability to repay, collateral, conditions, where we are, cash, character. And they told me, Gary, when you have the money, you are Mr. Polk. When you give the money, you're Gary. They may not remember your name because now you gave your leverage away, your money. You better make sure your borrower has character, because a person with character will figure a way to pay you back because they gave you their word. A person without character could have the capacity to pay you and want to see you in court anyway. So character becomes so important of doing the right thing. And our number one value at the Polk Institute, character, doing the right thing when no one is watching.
Right.
That is so important.
I agree. I think that's important in life.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, absolutely. I mean, I don't have a business, but I do think that that's important. And I like your website. I know I keep mentioning this, but when I'm looking at your level one incubator, and I'm looking at your level two accelerator, and I'm looking at your level three legacy. What I think is also very interesting about this page specifically is you can learn more about each program, you can submit an application, and you can choose to become a facilitator. So there could be somebody listening right now that said, man, this is exactly what I was thinking about doing. And I think that that makes your website just phenomenal, frankly.
Thank you.
Get involved and donate, and your events. It shouldn't surprise me based on what it is you do. But for anybody listening thinking, I need to know more about this. I know Marsha's asking a bunch of questions, but I want to delve a little deeper. And you don't have to live in Los Angeles to be involved in this, correct?
Correct. We do most of the things on Zoom. And so we have clients out of state, and we have facilitators out of state, because if you can handle the time difference, then we can work with you.
Yep.
Remember, we started in COVID and everything was Zoom, and we didn't meet some of our leaders. We never met in person for 2 years.
Wow. Isn't that something in person? Isn't that something? And yes. Yet, look at how you succeeded under such dire straits, right?
Well, I had a little help from the man upstairs. I don't mind giving credit to that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this. You have an annual golf tournament scheduled in August. What is that all about?
Well, I'm glad you asked. One of the hardest things that I've encountered as running a nonprofit is raising money.
Yeah.
And last year we had our first golf tournament. In golf tournaments, it was interesting. I was talking to one of my leaders, and she works with another organization. And they just had their big dinner. And I say, oh, wow, that must be your primary fundraiser. She said, oh, no, golf tournament is our number one. Wow. And it was just so ironic. The morning of the same day, one of my board members said, Gary, I haven't done everything I want to do for you. I just did a couple golf tournaments. I will chair up a golf tournament. How does that sound?
Oh,
I said,
gosh.
That sounds like a lot of work, but if you're willing to do it. And so the same afternoon, my other colleague, she tells me about a golf tournament she was involved in. And she said, do you need help? I said, yeah. She said, I'll help you.
Oh my gosh.
So in one day, I got two co-chairs to run a golf tournament. So we had our first golf tournament last year. We had a Navy golf down in Long Beach where Tiger Woods learned how to play. And we had pretty good success. We made some money. We had about 68 golfers out there. So we said, well, let's do it again. We're going to do it on August 14th, 2026. We're going to go back to Navy Golf down in the Long Beach area. They call it Seal Beach. It's Seal Beach and Long Beach are right adjacent to each other. And this year, we're going to try to get to 100 to 120 golfers. And so we came up with a couple strategies. Last year, we may have had a dozen women. This year, we want to have about 20 women golfers and have a women's division.
Nice.
We want to bring in Chamber of Commerce and have a Chamber of Commerce division and keep our open division. So now we'll have three different divisions that are there for fun to raise money in what we call friendly competition. So we'll have a hole-in-one where you can win $50,000 cash if you hit a hole-in-one, and the ball has to travel only about 160-some yards and fall in that hole on one shot.
Wow.
We have a putting contest. Cool. Oh, that's a lot of fun. Yeah. A lot of people gravitate to that. And the way we do it, I don't know if you're familiar with golf, we put you in foursomes, and you play best ball. So four people hit the ball. Whoever hits the best ball, everyone picks up and plays off the best ball.
It's so like it's really a team. Is that what they, my brother's a golfer. Is that what they used to call closest to the pin?
Well, no. Closest to the pin is where you have a par three, maybe 150 yards, and who can hit it closest to the pin without going in.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
So hole in one is when it goes in. Closest to the pin is when it comes 6 inches short or 1 foot short.
Got it.
And then we'll have a longest drive hole where who can hit it the farthest, but in the regulation boundaries. So for that, we have a men and women division separate. So we have a women's division, longest drive, men division, longest drive. But the hole in one and closer to the pin, that's just one competition for everybody.
I see.
Yep. And so we compete. We also add a silent auction. We have sports memorabilia. We have celebrity memorabilia. We have trips. We have other golf outings. We have Airbnb. So again, its primary focus is to raise money for the Institute. Again, raising money is hard. And so this year, our theme is Swing for Good.
Oh, nice. I like that. That's a really good play on words. That's terrific. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your books.
Okay.
I think it's the titles are very, would you like to tell the titles of the books? Because you're welcome to do so.
No problem.
Okay.
So the first book I wrote is Why Entrepreneurs Fail, to Win. So the genesis of the title was, I have a marketing background. I was a marketing major in undergrad, and I knew why entrepreneurs fail would get someone's attention. They want to, why do they fail? But then in the parentheses, we put to win, because that's a little teaser, because really the book is an empowerment book to help you win. So Why Entrepreneurs Fail to Win is a college textbook that I wrote in 1999 and still being used today.
Wonderful.
And I wrote that book as if it would be my first and my last book. So I put everything into it, all the good teaching stuff, all the good stories I had, I put into this book. And in the process, I had some fun.
Yeah.
So we decided, well, let's do a sequel. Why Black and Brown Entrepreneurs Fail to Win. And so in that book, we wanted to address some things that maybe were unique to Black and Brown. So one of the things that we found out in our research is the issue of self-doubt.
Oh.
And the question became, does self-doubt hold you back from being an entrepreneur? Because a lot of times in the Black and Brown community, sometimes we doubt ourselves. Sometimes others doubt us. Sometimes we might have this, what they call the imposter syndrome. I don't deserve this. I don't belong here, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to squash that mentality. Because once you go through maybe some issues of being black or brown, guess what? You're still going to be an entrepreneur. You're still going to have to deal with the issues of founding team, recruiting people to be on your team, marketing, cash flow, competition, and all the other challenges that every business owner has. So after we wrote that book, we say, you know what? Let's make it a trilogy. We work with a lot of women. So let's write our third book, Why Women Entrepreneurs Fail to Win. So I asked one of my colleagues who had just wrote, did some research on access to capital and women. So I said, okay, Jennifer, let's make the first chapter a juicy one. Why women have a hard time getting access to capital. Because in her research, she found that about 90% of venture capital money go to white males.
Really?
Really. Mm-hmm. And so as you get deeper and deeper, you find out, yeah, access to capital is tough. But then when we did our research, we found out women have a few unique things. And Jennifer, being my co-author, she said, Gary, how about family life, work-life balance? Okay, Jennifer, you write that chapter. Hey, Gary, how about this? How about that? I said, okay, well, save me a couple. So one of the things, I was at a seminar, and we had these venture capitalists. It was an amazing little short story where a woman, there was only one venture capital woman on the panel, and a lady in the audience said, hey, I want to ask that female venture capitalist something. She said, yes, what is that? What advice can you give us? She said, I'm glad you asked.
Oh.
She said, why do women have to be so pragmatic? Why can the male CEO of a startup walk up and say, we're going to do $25 million in our first year of operation, or $5 million in first year and $25 million in 5 years? And then the woman CEO comes up and say, well, we want to do $1 million. Why the big difference? And then in the research, we found out that women want to keep it real. So we asked a question, does being too pragmatic hold you back from dreaming big? Because we don't want that. There's a entrepreneur thought leader out there named Seth Godin, and he said, start small, but dream big. And so every time I talk to women entrepreneurs, I said, tell me your five-year goal. What does success look like in 5 years? Oh, I want to do $500,000. I said, really? Can you do more than that? Can you dream of 5 million? Well, I hadn't thought of it like that. I said, well, maybe you should. I want to empower women to dream big. I want to empower men to dream big. But again, women have this more pragmatic, maybe even more realistic. And the woman VC said, well, maybe men know how to play the game better. Maybe they know if they start big, people are going to chop them down anyway, so they may as well start big. Now, you could go too far and say, I want to be $50 billion in 5 years. Well, we got to talk you off the cliff on that one.
Right.
But if a guy can do a $5 million business in 5 years, why couldn't a woman? But it's between your ears. And we know that 6 inches between your ears is your brain. And we know how powerful our brain is.
Yep.
So that's our women book, yes.
You know, I guess I was thinking, if you have these really large goals, what happens as you're going towards those goals if you have these setbacks? How do you pick yourself back up?
Well, it's called failure. And one thing you got to find out, all you got to know, is that entrepreneurship, especially in startup mode, is a failure sport. I'm a baseball fan. I love my Dodgers.
Me too.
But every baseball fan knows that if you get 3 hits out of 10 at-bats, you're batting 300. And if you do that for a 20-year career, they put you in the Hall of Fame, and they don't even care that you struck out 7 times or fail 70% of the time. Well, entrepreneurship is the same way.
I see.
Failure is part of the business. I teach it as a failure sport. 7 out of 10 are going to fail. Follow what I say, and you still could fail because the nature of the business. Well, why do people take that risk? Because today we call it financial freedom. We want to be our own boss. We want to work for ourselves, to try to have that certain lifestyle, to do what you want to do, when you want to do it, and where you want to do it.
Right.
And that's what entrepreneurship is really about, being your own boss. But you got to know going in, you could fail.
There's some risks involved.
But failure is okay, so long as we learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you as a teacher, failure might be the best teacher of them all. Because if you get something wrong and thought you had it right, once you figure it out, you never forget that. And I think that is very powerful and very important for people to understand. So if failure makes you quit, then you lost. If failure keeps you going, then you have a chance to win. And maybe that failure helped you win. One of my favorite stories in entrepreneur world, a guy failed 21 times and got it right on number 22.
Huh.
That's perseverance.
Yes.
So one of the things we start asking later is our interview process, do you have grit? What do you mean? Are you a quitter? Of course not. Well, if you're doing something for the money, you may quit. If you're doing something because it's your passion, you're not going to quit.
No.
So as rough as I may have had it over the 5 years of running the Polk Institute, quitting was never an option because this is my passion. And I love what I do.
It's clear. You can hear it. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to know, is there something that's next for you that we should know about?
Well, the Silver Tsunami, we're in pilot mode now. We hope in 27. Well, I'll take that out. We know in 27 we're going to launch in full scale. We want to have success locally in the Southern California area, but our goal is to roll this out nationwide.
Nice.
We want to have a nationwide process because that aspirational goal of getting to 1,000, we can get there by riding this wave called the Silver Tsunami. So that's really something that is not keeping me up at night, but make me excited to wake up the next morning.
I bet. It's kind of like the Dodgers, right, honey? Because I had to tell you, you mentioned the Dodgers. I just had to throw this in there. I have been a Dodgers season ticket holder since 1986.
Oh, wow.
With 200 families here in Westchester.
Okay, great.
So I like the Dodgers, too. You grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in Los Angeles. Do you have a favorite basketball team?
Lakers.
Okay, well, I'll let you have the Lakers. I'm a Clippers fan. But guess what else I am, my friend?
I hope a Ram fan.
Well, no, we're still on basketball for a moment.
Okay.
I'm an original Sparks season ticket holder, and this is our 30th year with the WNBA.
That's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, I got a chance to do some summer coaching with the Sparks. My head coach down at Cypress College when I was coaching down there was an assistant coach, and during the summer we went up and helped out on the coaching. So I started coaching women's basketball instead of men's basketball, and when I did finally coach the boys, I realized I made a mistake. I found out the boys were not as coachable as the girls, so I prefer women's basketball coaching over men any day. And yes, I'm a Sparks fan myself. I'm an L.A. sports fan.
Yep, me too. Me too. So, I just want to thank you for sharing so much information for our listeners to consider maybe doing a pivot and thinking about how they might want to approach what they're doing in their lifestyle right now. This has just been a wonderful conversation, Gary, and I just want to thank you so very much for joining me again today.
Thank you, especially that you're a Dodger fan. Double thank you.
Okay, well, do you go to the games, my friend?
I do. I was there that Ohtani, that great game where he did the strikeouts and the home runs. I was April 10th when we had the dramatic comeback. I go to about, I'm not a season ticket holder. I can't afford that. But I go to at least a dozen games a year.
Terrific. Well, yep. Listen, go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers.
And thank you once again for sharing your wisdom with our listeners today. It's been a true pleasure, and I really am glad you were able to talk with me today, Gary.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me. Can I give one more plug to the Dodgers?
Please. Yes.
Last year, Dave Roberts was driving me crazy with some of his decisions, and I told my wife I came up with something called TID, Trust in Dave. Whatever decision he makes, just go with it.
There you
go. He got me through the season, and we won a World Series. Because it seemed like in the World Series, every decision he made was the right decision.
Yep. Yep.
And so we won back-to-back, and now hopefully we'll win three. But trust in Dave if you're ever doubting Dave Roberts and his decisions. He's definitely a Hall of Fame manager.
I was at the game when Kirk Gibson hit that home run.
Oh, okay. My goodness. Yes.
Well, listen, thanks once again. And you're welcome. A lovely rest of your day. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Take care of yourself.
Bye, everyone. All right.
Goodbye.